Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelow. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. The South Shore's Morning News, and we do have a special guest in studio with more good news.
Admiral, there'll be whales here.
Oh, thank you, Scotty. Yep, that's Star Trek IV where they save the whales. And this man wants to save the whales. He has made it his mission to have a right whale day in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. April 24, to be specific, will be the day. And we're proud to say that is official now. And Matt Delaney is in studio from Pembroke. Matt, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rob.
Great to have you in studio. Thanks for joining myself and Christine James.
Well, thanks for having me again. Gosh, twice in 1 week, but this is huge.
Yep, it really is. We wanted to have you back. I know earlier in the week you were here with your representative, State Rep Josh Cutler, who worked to get this, and of course it made it through the House, and it made it through the Senate, and yesterday it was officially signed by the outgoing governor, Governor Charlie Baker.
Yeah, it was, I had to sweat it out a little bit, I guess. The Senate waited until the last minute on Tuesday, because after Tuesday, they wouldn't have been able to vote on it, because a new legislature was coming in.
I still don't understand. Christine, do you know why they wait till these last minute and have to go late all the time?
I don't know, but I think it has something to do with like when everybody was in school and you had a current events report due the next day, and you waited till the last minute.
Yeah,
I have no explanation.
They have to go until like 1 or 2 in the morning. Why don't they start at 5 a.m. and get things done? I mean, we start the show at 5, right?
I don't know.
Rather than later.
Well, the House passed it in the fall, so they had some time. I don't know why they had to wait till the last day just to give me heart failure, I guess.
Well, thank goodness you're here. You're wearing your Right Whale Day shirt, by the way, everyone there. It's got a great logo on there that was designed by one of Matt's daughters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, was designed by Erica, and she's really a talented young lady, and and then, you know, everybody was calling me up the day they saw Charlie Baker walk out of the State House and do his final walk and say, well, what's going to happen now? He's all done.
I said,
technically, he is still the governor until they swear in the new one.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, I was in a meeting and I got a text from Josh at about 10:45, and I think the swearing in was 11 a.m., and he said, it's official. The governor signed it.
So that's technically that's the last right of his.
About 90 things he had to sign.
Wow.
Yeah, and apparently.
Is he a lefty too, left-handed, Charlie Baker?
He is a lefty.
Okay. Yeah. Right, just like myself. That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, so that left hand was sitting getting a workout there.
Yeah.
He signed, I mean, there were other things. As you said, he didn't get to everything.
That's what I heard.
But Right Whale Day was signed. So it's official.
Thank goodness for that. It's, you know, and I got to thank an awful lot of people, and I know I'm probably going to leave somebody out, so I won't mention anybody except for this station who has been very instrumental in helping promote this. You know, we've been working on it since March of 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years this mid-March. So, I mean, it's...
Wow.
It was a great effort by Josh, and he coached me properly to get some letters from some great organizations, and I think those all helped. And, you know, the on-air stuff here at WATD, all of you in here, mm-hmm. Christine, Ed Perry, yourself, Dan McCready, and Lenny has been terrific as well. As it's just such a great organization, this one here. A real community, heartfelt radio station. None like it anywhere.
Well, thank you,
Matt.
Thank
you. And I like my tote bag, too.
We were the Right Whale Day tote bag.
It matches the T-shirt.
Now available.
Yeah.
April 24th. So, Matt from Pembroke, it is official. So, on every April 24th in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we will remember and talk about why this day is so important. So why don't you tell us what you would like people to think about on April 24th for Right Whale Day? What's the whole meaning behind this?
Well, the idea is to get more awareness, because you talk to a lot of people and they don't realize that, for goodness sakes, there's less than 350, about 340 of these things left on the planet. And if we keep going the way we are, they're going to be gone. So we need to educate more, starting with young children, you know. There should be a Right Whale Day class once a month in school. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really are a majestic creature. And they are they've been our state mammal for a long time, but there's never been a day dedicated to promoting awareness about the right whales. And, you know, that's really, really what it's all about. You know, we started celebrating Whale Day, you know, in 2004. And the more and more we learned about it, the more and more we realized, my goodness, these things might be gone someday. And they, you know, I don't know, I guess I came up with this crazy idea after being cooped up during COVID. And I called Josh's office in March of 21, and he ran with it. He, you know, on April 24th, he filed the bill in 2021. So pretty exciting that it actually went through. I mean, I was willing to go forward if we had to, if it didn't go through, but it's kind of nice knowing what we've gone through to this point. So that's awesome.
So this is a critically endangered species, right? The right whale. You mentioned it only numbers and on a planet this size where there are millions and, I guess, with humans, billions. But for this creature, there's only 340
about
on the whole planet.
They're going to do another count now that right whale, some of them have been giving birth to calves, and then they'll start to make their journey northward and arrive down at the Cape at the beginning of April, with the high point for that right around April 24th when we saw the one swim by our car at Race Point.
So, you know, since obviously we're not hunting whales, what's causing whales to become endangered around here?
Well, from what they say, it's mostly ship strikes and rope entanglement. And, you know, the rope entanglement is really tough because they suffer for months, sometimes close to a year, with ropes around them until they die. And, you know, there's got to be a way that lobster fishermen and the fishing industry can coexist with right whales. The technology is out there.
Yeah.
I think the federal government needs to subsidize this. They subsidize an awful lot of things.
Yeah, make it easy for people. You know, we have nothing against people in those industries. We know how tough it is.
I got lobstermen that are friends.
Yeah, and, I know.
You know,
So we've got a way to coexist. I mean, we should be able to figure something out, right? We're smart. We can take care of it. And we want to make sure that the whales continue to exist. So that's what Right Whale Day will be all about. Jim from the text line says, is it possible wind turbines could be endangering their migration path in the future? Turbines could also hurt birds as well. That's Jim on the text line. So I don't know. It's possible. I don't know.
It's possible. And I don't really have an answer for that, because so many people are for that, but there's been a lot of people fighting it as well. I wish I had an answer for everything. I probably wouldn't be sitting in here.
508 says, what about Holtec dumping radioactive water into Cape Cod? There's someone else chiming in on that. Will that benefit right whales? Well, there's a lot of things to look at. You're right. Yeah. You don't necessarily have the answers, but you want to make sure that we start thinking about this and looking at all the things that could be endangering.
It's all about awareness. And, you know, Josh wants to have a special day up at New England Aquarium. I'm looking into that. I've already sent an email to the president, Vicky.
And you got to do something.
Maybe we'll have a big party up there.
Yeah, you tell him about it.
On April 24th.
We'll be there.
Yeah.
We'll all be there. Maybe we'll do a broadcast.
Yeah, send Lenny.
We'll send Lenny there. Maybe Ed Perry, too, if you want him.
Oh, that'd be something. I don't know. Does he drive that far?
Oh, yeah. He drives everywhere.
Yeah, he's a special.
You ever ride with him? In the car?
I did one time on the vineyard.
Yeah, we can talk about that off the air if you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Matt Delaney, the South Shore's biggest right whale fan.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for having me, and thank you, Christine.
Good morning.
If I had a mushroom, I'd tell you what I'd do. I would take the mushroom and split it in two. Oh, if I had a mushroom, I'd tell you what I'd do.
We're going to talk about mushrooms. New book out. This is great for kids. Great for anyone, really. It's called Mason Goes Mushrooming. And it's written by Melanie Kahn. She joins us now to talk all about it. Melanie, good morning and welcome to WATD.
Oh, good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a great book, amazing illustrations, and we'll talk about that. But Melanie, you say that this is a true story, and I know right here from your biography, it says you yourself have experience hunting for mushrooms going back to the late 60s in Vermont.
That's right. Mushroom hunting is a wonderful family activity, and it's gotten what I call a bad reputation. Because it's actually something that can be learned and done safely through what I like to think of as an oral tradition of learning the way somebody might learn how to hunt or fish from their grandparents. Mushroom hunting is very much the same, and there's some fantastic mushroom clubs right in the area that your listeners might already be familiar with. The Boston Mycological Society is one of them. And you can go out with groups of people and learn about all of these wonderful treasures that are available right in our literal backyards, neighborhoods, playgrounds, woods, hiking trails. They're everywhere. Mushrooms are everywhere.
Yeah, well, it says here in the press release here about your book, mushroom foraging is growing in popularity, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And you were saying it got a bad rap. Was it almost maybe a lost art for a while? I mean, because we know, as you talked about, people would pass down the tradition, Melanie, through their families for many, many years. And then what, did we get away for it and now we're getting back?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think the answer to that is that there is an element to mushroom foraging, just like there is to many hobbies, that has to be taken with a grain of safety. And I think that the emphasis became a little bit too heavily on the safety and not on the educational and the environmental aspects of being able to do this. So it is a bit of a lost art. I think that is a good way to describe it.
Yeah, it'd be sort of rather than take the time to learn, you just say, all mushrooms are dangerous, stay away. But that's not true. Okay. So this gets into the book, Mason Goes Mushrooming. So set it up for us, Melanie. Tell us about this story.
So Mason is my actual son. He's now 20 years old. But as a family, when my kids were little, and of course when I was little, my parents took me as well, we used to go out foraging, and we learned with our local mushroom club. We would go out and look for morels in the spring and for chanterelles in the summertime and for the black trumpet, the elusive black trumpet in the fall. And my kids found it to be very exciting and stimulating, like a treasure hunt, you know, like finding that one seashell at the beach that you're looking for, or the starfish, or finding some other, there's other things in the woods too, newts and salamanders and terrific things that kids enjoy. So we found it to be a very wonderful and invigorating family activity. And there was no children's books out there about the joys of the forest and the treasure hunt. So I took it upon myself to write one. And it's a very simple concept. It's four mushrooms, four recipes, four seasons, four little adventures between Mason, my son, and his dog Buddy, who go out hunting for mushrooms in each of the different seasons.
Oh, that's great. So this is a book you can read with your kids, you can share, and also do some cooking.
Yeah, so the recipes are tucked in, and they're kid-friendly recipes. It's really, when you're cooking, I hear often that people don't like mushrooms, and I like to say, I think what you don't like about them is the texture, because if you cook a mushroom to a crispy, almost meat-like way, the way you might handle a steak, for example, you know, where you give it a little bit of a char on the outside and you crisp it up, you can really elicit that umami flavor, that wonderful sort of meaty flavor that crispy mushrooms have. And that's what each of these recipes do. There's a recipe just for a baked mushroom chip, and it's literally put it in a little olive oil, a little sea salt, and put it in the oven and let them crisp up, and then they do taste like yummy potato chips.
Tell us about the illustrations. You worked with a woman, I guess she came from L.A. and worked in New York, right? Is she a friend of yours?
She actually is. Ellen Korbonsky is a fantastic children's book illustrator, and she and I went to school together. And when it was, she lives in New York City, and she came up to visit me in Vermont, and one day she was just doing some watercolors out the window, and I said, Ellen, those are so good. I have this book in me. Would you be willing to collaborate with me on it? And she said, sure. And the book was born. And then it took about a year of back and forth to get it to a place where we could finally show it to a publisher. And then the rest has been a somewhat historic, you know, we're both in our late 50s. So for both of us, it's a first time effort to write a book. And it's lovely to have it be so well received.
We're talking about the new children's book, Mason Goes Mushrooming, by Melanie Kahn. It's available now. And what advice, Melanie, would you have maybe for parents that are hearing this and saying, you know what, maybe I'd like to do this with my family. How would we go about doing this and learning more? What advice would you have for some parents out there?
Well, the first thing is I bet a lot of your listeners are more interested in foraging than you know, than we know, because, like I said, it is growing in popularity, and people are doing it. These clubs are just, you know, burgeoning. They're really getting a lot new members. And I would suggest going out with other people who know what they're doing. I would also suggest going out not with the intention of eating mushrooms, but just to examine them, look at them, pick them. You can touch any mushroom, you just can't ingest certain mushrooms. So, you know, go out mushrooming, wash your hands afterwards, but you can look at them. You can examine them and check out their cool colors, and you can make spore prints with them, which is when they sit on a piece of paper and their seeds drop, and they make a beautiful, beautiful piece of art. So there's all sorts of things you can do to start a relationship with fungi that is not necessarily anything to do with eating them. Just go out and look at them in the forest and see how many there are. And I like to say, once you start to see mushrooms, you can't not see them, because they're literally everywhere, and they are vital to our existence. They take care of all the soil. They're absolutely critical to our existence.
Yeah. Well, what a great, and you're right about, you know, sometimes we may not notice them, but kids always notice mushrooms, and that's why it's great to learn about it. And this would be a good thing, as you talked about, it was a tradition in your family, and so you would like to maybe share it with others.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes parents can relate to not being able to get their kids to be interested in going out on walks or out in the woods, and it gives a walk a sense of purpose. So you can say, hey, let's go outside and see what mushrooms we can find. And kids will sort of spark at that idea that there's something mystical and magical about mushrooms. And so even if you just want to, like I said, see how many, for example, just let's look and see how many different types we can see, you know. And then you start noticing them on trees and coming out of the sidewalk cracks and, you know, in the golf courses. And then you can start to build on that knowledge.
Mason Goes Mushrooming, new children's book written by Melanie Kahn. And it's available now, Melanie, right, for people to order online or in stores?
Absolutely. Amazon has it. But also I love to suggest that people go to their local bookstore. I love to support our local small towns and their bookstores, because we need them. So any of those places. But it's a wonderful gift for kids. But I'm hearing that grown-ups like it a lot, too.
Oh, that's great. Well, Melanie, thank you for taking the time to be with us on WATD and sharing the details about this new children's book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you on WATD. Mason Goes Mushrooming, Melanie Kahn, MalanyKahn. Paws and Claws time on WATD. And Paws and Claws, proudly sponsored by our good friends over at the Clean Team. I want to thank the Clean Team for joining us again for another year of sponsoring Paws and Claws. They do a great job. And as we know, even the best pets can't clean up their own mess. Call the Clean Team to take care of fur, furniture, paw tracks, tiles, and all sorts of catastrophes and doggy dilemmas. Visit thecleanteam.com. www.thebeginningsofmusic.net. Okay, so as we do at the beginning part of the month on Paws and Claws, we check in with the great team over at the VCA, South Shore Animal Hospital in Weymouth, vcasouthshore.com. And Dr. Kira Berg is with us this morning. She is board-certified specialist in zoological medicine. She joins us now. Good morning, Dr. Berg.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Paws and Claws. So let's see, what are some of the things we're going to get into this month? And we're going to talk about vaccines and ferrets?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so ferrets are legal in Massachusetts, and depending on the state, they may be illegal. But we are super honored to have them be allowed in Massachusetts as pets. They make really wonderful pets. And it's also really important to vaccinate them just like a cat or a dog because of some of the diseases that they can potentially get, both from a perspective of protecting humans and other animals like our dogs. So ferrets are legally required to be vaccinated for both distemper and rabies. And I can definitely talk about that more, but I wasn't sure if you had any specific questions about that before I talk about those diseases.
No, I guess not. I mean, I guess it was a while back we did have a woman that came in to talk about ferrets, and she brought a couple of them into the studio. And I had not been really familiar with that, but Diane came in. She's the founder of South Shore Ferret Care and Rescue, and she came in to talk about educating people because I think a lot of us might not know much about ferrets, or some people probably thought, I don't even think you can have those as pets, but I guess, you know, we can, and they need care and need to be properly cared for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they make really wonderful pets. They're super lively and playful, very, very affectionate. They're definitely not necessarily a first-time pet, I would say, but I do think that they can make just the most wonderful additions to a family. In terms of the vaccine, since I know that's the topic for today, the ferrets do need to be seen ideally when they're young. A lot of people will get them from pet stores. There are some local breeders that are a little bit harder to find, so typically they come from pet stores or come from Marshall Farms. And so they're given one distemper vaccine, but they do need two more distemper vaccines to round out the series as a kit. And the kit, K-I-T, is the name for a baby ferret. They're super cute.
Oh, okay.
And then they also need their rabies vaccine. And then after, they can get the vaccine once a year for both distemper and rabies. With cats and dogs, eventually cats and dogs can get rabies vaccinated every 3 years. But unfortunately for ferrets, they do need to be legally vaccinated every year.
Okay. So, again, that's the law. Yeah. So if you're going to have a ferret as a pet, and Dr. Berg says they make pets, maybe, again, not for first-time pets or someone, you know, very young, probably, I guess, best to start with the fish and then work your way up to ferret. But if you're going to have a ferret, you do need to know that you're responsible for this type of these type of vaccines and the proper care that they need. So that's the law. So what, every year?
Yes. So every year they do need to be vaccinated. The other tricky thing with ferrets is that they can be prone to vaccine reactions. So it's a little bit different than cats and dogs. You know, the risk is there for cats and dogs, but for ferrets, it's well known that their risk of a reaction is higher. So they can get really itchy. Sometimes they can have vomiting or diarrhea. So what we do is we do need to give them Benadryl prior to the vaccine. And we do one vaccine at a time. So a lot of the times that means that ferret owners will need to make two appointments with around anywhere between 2 and 4 weeks between so that we can vaccinate either distemper or rabies and then in a couple weeks do the other vaccine. So there is that to keep in mind that they will need to be technically seen at least twice in that year so that they can get the vaccine series that they need.
Okay. So those are the kind of things that you'd need to know about. Obviously, different than dogs and cats, a different species. What would they be related to? Anything?
So these guys are in the family Mustelidae. They're closely related to otters. They're related to mink and weasels, mongoose, are a little bit farther related. So different family, but, same body shape.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those kind of other creatures we probably wouldn't have as pets. No, we wouldn't have a weasel.
Correct.
Or an otter. Okay. So the ferret, but that's the species they're related to. Okay. So those are the kind of things that you need to know. So they need those special types of vaccines. And is there anything else that we should know about ferret care in terms of if we were going to adopt one or get one?
Sure. Yeah. So they are also prone to periodontal disease or dental disease like cats and dogs. So they would benefit from being trained to accept teeth brushing, just like our kitties and our puppies. And if they are not tolerant of that, which is very understandable, then also having them brought in for cleaning their teeth, just like we do with our cats and our dogs. So fortunately, the medicine is generally quite similar between our cats and dogs. So in that respect, it can be an easy transition pet. You know, if you start with a cat or a dog and then we decide we want to add a ferret to the family, they're also prone to fleas and ticks, so they should also get their topical preventative, much like cats or dogs. So that kind of, extrapolation between the care for these animals is pretty similar. They are considered carnivores, so they can be fed like cats, but they have their own special diet that I would recommend for them. So there's a couple different brands of ferret food that would be best for them. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, okay, because, obviously cat, dog, fish food, easy to find. Where would you, I guess a bigger pet store must have ferret food.
Yep. Yeah. So anything like Petco or PetSmart and even some of the more local pet stores would have ferret food. It's also readily available online. And there's at least four brands out there. So there's lots of options in terms of like what an owner would want in terms of kibble or canned food. And it's specifically for ferrets, which is great.
Dr. Berg, have you ever brushed the teeth of a ferret? I'm not looking forward to that.
I mean, I have, but I have the luxury of being able to do it while they're under anesthesia. That part of my job makes it a little bit easier, but certainly they can be trained that you could, give them a little bit of treat and then, brush their teeth. It's a little bit different because, with humans, we don't want to eat after we've brushed our teeth. But with animals, we can't guarantee that same amount of compliance or, readiness to accept teeth brushing.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's okay if we can do, a little bit of treat, brush one side, a little bit of treat, brush the other side.
Okay. All right. Dr. Kira Berg with us, a board-certified specialist in zoological medicine, and she is with VCA, South Shore Animal Hospital in Weymouth, vcasouthshore.com. Part of Paws and Claws on WATD. And Dr. Berg, thank you. We'll talk to you in February. Take care.
Yes. We'll see you next month. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9watd.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9watd.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.